Liberation movements throughout the Third World, however, are throwing off U.S. imperialism. At the same time, the Soviet Union is trying to come in and take over where the U.S. is being kicked out. Both the Soviet Union and the United States are stepping up their preparation for a new world war. Both are stepping up their arms race, their armaments, and things of this sort. While both are talking about peace and detente and disarmament, this is really just a smokescreen for increased war preparations. These two governments will go to war. They have to go to war in order for their economic survival. And why we women here and the American people oppose this war, must oppose this war, we must also be prepared for it. We must not be fooled by this talk of detente.
Again,
we cannot depend on the U.S. government and the Soviet Union. We must oppose imperialism if we oppose war.
I must apologize. The time is up. There is a person down here in front who has a green card. You may want to watch, and I won't have to so rudely interrupt, but when she stands up with the thing, that means the time is up, and I'll have to interrupt otherwise if people don't see it. Back to microphone number one.
Thank you very much. My name is Gregoria Beatty, and I'm from Guam, a tiny island in the Pacific near Micronesia. I was also at the Tribune, and we were informed by the non-governmental delegates there that they were, the First World delegates were briefed by their government to, yes, talk about equality, yes, talk about development, but no, don't talk about peace. Where are the women today? Where are they? We were all there for equality at the sessions. We are there for the development. But where are we for peace? Where are the women here? I just wanted to say a few words about Micronesia and tell you what's happening, or what has happened. March 1st, 1954, a bomb named Bravo was detonated in a tiny atoll called Bikini. And thank you, Dr. Helen. I forgot your last name. But people, I teach at the university, and my students come there, and they're also victims of cancer and other things that come about medically from these explosions. The French and the Chinese are doing it still in the Pacific. They are storing nuclear weapons right a few meters from where I live in Nimitz Hill in Guam. Yes, there are medical impacts on what happens, but also I think we should be aware of the social changes that go on. These people in these islands were relocated. There were other islands that were affected, and they were moved en masse from island to island, having to adjust to these changes, to these new lifestyles. They have to change their traditional lifestyles. The environmental impacts on the fragile islands, fragile atolls, what happens to the fish and their subsistence, their environment, they live off of the water. What happens to the water and the economic alternatives? The United States has a responsibility to give economic alternatives to the trust territory of the Pacific, and they're not doing it.
Thank you very much.
My time is up.
I'm sorry. Thank you very much, too.
Thank you.
Microphone number two.
Yes, my name is Jan Kate, and I would like to continue the talk of the woman from Guam. I'm a member of the Women's International League for Peace and Freedom. I work for Women's Strike for Peace. I'm on the board of the United Nations Association, and I'm from the state of Washington, home of Dr. and Governor Dixie Lee Ray, Senator Henry Jackson, and the number one defense program of the world, the Trident submarine. I would, too, like to ask, where are the women of today? We met in our caucus in the state of Washington on international interdependence. We had 40 women. We came up with some excellent resolutions for women out of the, but only 40 out of 2,000 women that were attended the caucus in the state of Washington. I ask again, where are the women of today? We do have some questions. Number one, in the state of Washington, we need help from national and international people who are opposed to Trident, who are opposed to the U.S. buildup of arms. We also need to know how we can fight the tremendous arms lobby in the Washington, D.C. We are not in the hinterlands. We are right in the middle of the world with our problems of armaments. And we also know how we need to get peace education, the public school systems, when we have the military education supported by women all over the United States. While we stay here, we work for the equality of life, and the equality of death may well be forced upon us.
Pat, never mind.
We have some panelists who would like to make a comment.
I'd just like to suggest that you go to the afternoon session at 2 o'clock, where there are materials and coalitions, activist groups, addresses, many different things that you can do actively to inform yourself, to inform other people, and to influence the Congress.
Microphone number one.
I'm from the National Fight Back Organization. And we're marching in Washington on February 18th for jobs, and we're going to be raising the demand, jobs, not war. Our organization also calls for an end to superpower war preparations because we feel that a war between the United States and the Soviet Union would not in any way be in the interest of the people all over the world. It would only be a war to enrich the governments of those countries. At the same time, however, there have been just wars in this world. The World War II against German fascism and imperialism was a just war. The Vietnamese struggle against American imperialism was a just war. All over the world, third world countries are fighting for liberation against imperialism, both the United States and the Soviet Union. I cannot oppose their taking up arms against imperialism to throw off those regimes. I think we have to draw a distinction between just and unjust wars and wholeheartedly support third world liberation struggles. I think it's important for women because in our struggle for equality, those countries struggling against imperialism are our allies. Thank you.
Thank you. Microphone number two.
My name is Marie Dunkel. I'm from Maryland, an observer. I appreciate the presentation made by Dr. Caldicott. However, I strongly object to one of her statements, the idea that more nuclear power plants in the world is synonymous with more nuclear bombs. No weapon has ever been made from any fuel produced in any commercial nuclear power plant in the world. The reasons weapons have not been made from commercial nuclear plants and fuels is it is cheaper to use natural uranium and facilities designed and built for that purpose. The diversion of commercial nuclear plant fuel is the most expensive, clumsiest, dangerous, and inefficient way for any nation to make a weapon. To quote Senator Frank Church, knowledgeable scientists throughout the world dedicated to minimizing the threat of nuclear weapons have insisted that what is necessary to provide protection against weapons proliferation originating from civilian nuclear energy programs is strict international controls over reprocessing of nuclear fuels, including the manufacture of new fuel elements from reprocessed fuel. Our main deterrents for nuclear weapons should be through political, social, military, and economic initiatives. These are the main factors which will determine whether nations will seek nuclear weapons.
One of the panelists would like to make a comment here.
I think in this matter, as in all other matters, it's very important that we keep the facts straight. The fact is that the nuclear industry has for many years said that no nuclear weapon has ever been made from the waste product of a civilian power plant. About 4 weeks ago, the Joint Committee on one of the committees in the House released testimony that, in fact, the IRDA had performed a test where they took waste material from a civilian nuclear plant and produced a bomb, and it worked satisfactorily. So that simply isn't so.
Microphone number one.
Thank you. I'm Violet Hamilton, an elected delegate to IWY from Illinois, and I must say that I was very sorry when I received the press release last week announcing this hearing, that it appeared that only people of one persuasion would be heard. It seems to me that on considering the seriousness of the subject, a program so weighted to prevent only one side of the issue is not in the best interests of this country and our citizens. I'm going to have to cut this short because so that others will have an opportunity to try to be heard too, but I would like to challenge the statement about such statements as our monstrous defense budget. I must agree, when you take figures like $94 billion in 1975, for instance, or $100 billion or $110 billion, those figures standing by themselves do appear monstrous. But when you translate those to percentages and compare them with defense spending in previous years, a totally different picture emerges. For instance, in 1902, 87% of our federal budget went for defense purposes. By 1960, we were down to 50%, and in fiscal 1975, down to 24%. We're told we have to reorder priorities, that we have to have more for social spending. But the fact of the matter is, HEW-related programs have completely changed place with defense spending in the last 10 years. HEW-related programs are now pushing 50%. I wholeheartedly agree with your goal, ladies, of peace. I have to be concerned, too, with my daughters and my 12 grandchildren. But I must close with this. When you can convince the other countries to do what we've already done, we are far already on the road to disarmament. When you can convince others to do what we've already done, I'll join your crusade. Thank you.
Thank you. One of the panelists would like to respond.
I'd like to make 3 points. None of the panelists, I believe, have argued a pacifist position, regardless of what the panelists may think in their personal lives, and outside of this panel, we have not been discussing pacifism and total disarmament. We have been discussing a reasonable, defensive military posture. That's the first point. The second point is that the reason there has been a change of the kind you described in the percentage of the federal budget that goes to the Defense Department is because in 1900, the federal government didn't help us pay for education and for health. This country was not wealthy enough to do that. As we've grown more wealthy, we have been using our resources for social ends. At the same time, however, the defense budget has been growing in an absolutely incredible way, in the sense that this country never had a standing army of millions of men, at present 2 million men in peacetime before World War II. We had a few tens of thousands of men in the armed forces of this country from the Revolution to the Civil War, and from the Civil War to World War I, and from World War I to World War II. There was never a standing army in peacetime, and it is the result of this standing army that the military absorbs 5% or more than 5% of the national product now, compared with 1% of the national product around 1900. The third point, very briefly, is that military spending is not like other social goods, like education and health, in the sense that you expect that as you get more resources, more social wealth, you should also have more of these goods. There is no reason why the quantity of weapons that we need to be safe should grow at the same rate as our national product.
May I also? I would just like to add another fact that has not been brought up yet.
and that is that about half of all the scientists and engineers trained in this country are now working for defense and military purposes. That's an awful lot of talent put into this kind of activity. And many people now are concerned about the fact that the United States, in steel, in housing, and in many areas of our domestic civilian economy, are not competitive and are not being innovative. If we could take more of those scientists and engineers and put them into modernizing our steel facilities, making better housing, and all the rest, mass transit, pollution control, energy, then I think we would be on the way of really doing something for this country.
Microphone number two.
My name is Sharon Potter from Houston. I'm an observer. First of all, I'd like to thank all of you for being here. I've been very well informed during this hearing, and I appreciate your efforts. I have a question, two questions for Dr. Callicott. In her statement concerning leukemia, she gave me the impression that the only way a person can get leukemia is from irradiation of some kind, and I'd like for her to clear that up. And one other thing I'd like to know is, since this is a peace hearing and we're concerned about war, and most wars are caused by economic problems in the world, or many wars are caused by economic problems in the world, and during the current problem we're having now with energy, if she might not think that the use of nuclear power may be more of a deterrent to war, since it's a clean, cheap use of energy, than not. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Leukemia is probably caused by lots of things. We think viruses may cause it. We've never proved it. We think some chemicals can cause it. We're not sure. Some sort of inherited diseases or deformed babies like Mongols have a higher incidence of leukemia than other children, so therefore they have an inherited tendency to it. But the one thing we know that definitely causes it is radiation. In fact, if a pregnant woman has one plain abdominal X-ray during her pregnancy, it increases the incidence of leukemia in that child by 50%.
Do you use X-rays in your practice?
Pardon?
You're a pediatrician. Do you use X-rays in your practice?
We all use X-rays.
Okay, thank you.
Let's get on to X-rays just briefly. The more X-rays you have, X-rays have a very minimal danger. But the more X-rays you have, the more chance, minimally, that you might get a cancer, but very minimally. There are some X-rays that are done for defensive medicine now we tend to practice because of the lawyers and the litigation, like we take an X-ray of a hand when we feel there isn't a fracture, but we take it so that we don't get sued by the lawyers later. So if you ever have an X-ray, always ask your doctor why you're having it. But usually the benefits you get from having an X-ray and making a diagnosis far outweigh the minimal risk you have from an X-ray. Now let's talk about nuclear power. That statement is incorrect, that it's safe, clean, etc. Each 1,000 megawatt reactor makes 400 to 500 pounds of plutonium every year. Plutonium is the most carcinogenic, or one of them, toxic substances we've ever produced. It's man-made, and a millionth of a gram, if you get it into your lung, an amount you can't even see will give you a lung cancer. Biological extrapolation, if you took 10 pounds of it and you could put a little piece in every person's lung on Earth, this is theoretically, you could kill every man, woman and child on Earth with 10 pounds of plutonium. It also takes 10 pounds to make an atomic bomb. Plutonium has a half-life of 24,400 years. That means it's biologically active for 500,000 years. That means if I die of a lung cancer caused by plutonium and I'm cremated, the smoke goes out the chimney with the plutonium to be breathed into somebody else's lung ad infinitum. It's concentrated in food. But this is just one of the things that's made in nuclear reactors. There are several hundred extremely carcinogenic, poisonous, radioactive elements, some of which have lives for hundreds and thousands of years, and if they leak, which they're already doing in storage tanks throughout this country, they get concentrated in the food chain thousands of times at each step, and you don't know you're eating a piece of cheese with strontium-90 in it, and years later when you get a leukemia, that's caused by that strontium-90 you ate 15 years ago. And don't forget, I said babies are terribly sensitive to these effects. So that's a totally untrue statement. And they have not found the safe storage for waste from nuclear power plants yet, but they tell us to have faith they'll find the answer. And that's like me saying to a patient, you've got a cancer, you'll probably die in 6 months, but have faith in me, I'm a good doctor. In 20 years' time, I might find the cure.
Microphone. Microphone number one.
Yes, I, Tanya Winter, an observer from California. I would like to address myself also to the question of nuclear power. I'm active in a community organization in California that is concerned with the proliferation of nuclear power plants. And I think that it's very directly related to the whole question of peace and disarmament. Women, if they recognize the possibility of having some impact in their local communities, by beginning to work against nuclear power in their own backyard. As the doctor said, that the plutonium that is created by the plants is right in our own backyard. And I would like to alert all of you and the Congress people to the fact that President Carter's policy has been very deceptive. He has said that he's opposed to nuclear power. And then what he has done, he has vetoed the plutonium breeder bill, but at the same time he has said to the world, we will take your nuclear garbage, and he has said to the nuclear energy utilities, the federal government will assume responsibility for reprocessing and storing this nuclear garbage in our country, when they know very well that there has been no technology to reprocess or to store it safely. So I think we have to be very acutely aware of the deception. They are also proposing a bill which will outlaw the use of oil or gas for electricity within this country by 1985. And if they pass that bill, that will be a package invitation to the nuclear utilities to go ahead with their plans. I think that the movement against nuclear reactors, we know, is worldwide, but at the same time, it lends itself to local organizing and local action, because